Okay, very happy to be back now with the Reverend Vernon Walker, who is the policy director for the Young Democrats of Massachusetts. And before we even get started, we have to congratulate the Reverend Walker on being reinitiated into his post. You've been reelected as the policy director for the Young Dems. Is that correct?
Yes, and we'll be serving this year's term until 2021.
Very good. Well, congratulations, Reverend Walker. It's great. And as I've said before, I can't wait to get to meet you in person. So much has been going on. I really don't even know where to start, but I think the best place to start would be with politics. As the Young Democrats, of course, you guys are involved, of Massachusetts, are involved in this current political season, which involves not only the Massachusetts Senate race, but also a national race. And maybe tell me a little bit about where things are at the moment, because Representative Kennedy and Senator Markey have had a couple of debates so far, have they not?
Yes, and we actually held a town hall. The Young Dems have actually held a town hall with each candidate, Markey and Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an opportunity for young Democrats to ask some questions around the pressing issues and concerns that this generation is facing. And we're in the initial stages of doing a forum, of planning a forum with both of them at the same time, virtually.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still in the early stages of that. But people are pulled in so many different directions with that race, but it should be, it's exciting and equally fascinating to see the various debates that they've both been having and the various things that they've both been saying. So I think it's an interesting race so far.
You know, I was going to ask you, this is not unprecedented where a younger person or less qualified, I don't want to say less qualified, that's not the right term, but a younger person has challenged the incumbent within the same party. It presents some obstacles, obviously, but it also presents, I would think, some opportunities.
Yes, for a fresh voice, for new ideas, new vision. But the thing that's interesting that I find is that there's really no difference between Kennedy and Markey in terms of what they're saying they would advocate for.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, you know, age and name, it seems to be on policy that they're similar.
Well, you know, again, that is that is interesting, because then what do? You go by name recognition. If you're a voter, you go by, the guy you know, as they say, the devil you know. So I think it is going to make it extremely interesting in November. But I have noticed, and this is just obviously a layperson's viewpoint, I have noticed that Senator Markey has been more visible than ever. There was a time here when I really didn't even know what he looked like. So he has gotten really involved in local politics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he's been progressive on many of issues. Obviously, with the Green New Deal, with so many other issues, he has been on the forefront leading.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting.
If we helicopter up now and we bring the view up off of Massachusetts and sort of go down the East Coast and head down to Washington, what is the latest viewpoint with respect to the national election? Because obviously Vice President Biden has been hamstrung a little bit in terms of being able to get out visibly. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, so much is going on in this country right now. So what's the overview from the Massachusetts Young Dems viewpoint?
Well, a lot of us are, looking for ways to help Biden, Vice President Biden, secure a win in November. And at least from a lot of people I've talked to, they're interested in how can they help. Because I think people are united on the idea that we cannot have a divider in chief in the office. You know, we obviously know the president position is a commander in chief, but this current president has been a divider in chief, certainly with fanning the flames of hatred, fanning the flames of racism, fanning the flames of xenophobia, fanning the flames of just downright meanness. So we certainly, as a country, I think, deserve to have someone who is interested in uniting this country and not dividing, who is interested in lifting up the most vulnerable, who is interested in being a bold, helping the country again be a bold leader in the international community on climate change, and fighting against climate injustices. So I think people here are, you know, phone banking to swing states across the country. They're donating, they're phone banking, you know, and they intend on, when it's safe to do so, to go out and canvass to ensure that Vice President Biden becomes President Biden come next January.
Mm-hmm. Is there a push or a stand or a plank or however you phrase it, I'm not sure how to ask the question, with respect to a vice president pick for Joe Biden? Do the Mass Dems have a say in that? Do they have a platform where they advocate for that? How does that work?
Well, we don't have an official say on it per se, but you know, the Mass Dem is part of the Young Dems of America. Nationally, we can have a say on it, but statewide, mm-hmm. I mean, we all have our opinions on who it could be, read about Demings or Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren or Susan Rice. Or some feel that Stacey Abrams should be the pick. So there's so many different options out there that Vice President Biden could pick from. And so many qualified women that he could pick from.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be great if he's able to select a woman of color. We've never had a woman, to my knowledge, we've never had a woman of color serve as the vice president in this country. And I just think it would be great. In fact, I don't think we've ever had a woman serve as a vice president from any party, actually.
Well, that's true. Yeah, and you know, we're just beginning to get women as governors and things like that. And I think it might. Do you think it could excite the base, the Bernie base? Because a lot of kids I've talked with, you know, the college age, they say, "Nah, we're not going to vote." But wait a minute here. You know, you sort of have to. So I think perhaps that's part of the process, is thinking, how can we excite the Bernie base?
Well, I think Biden has formed a joint task committee with the Sanders campaign,
mm-hmm.
And there is a committee that they announced the formulation of within the last month, and the goal is to help push some of the progressive ideas that Sanders was pushing for. To help implement those ideas, mm-hmm. in a possible Biden presidency. So there is a joint task force made up of Sanders supporters and made up of Biden supporters, and they're coming together to develop a comprehensive, bold, and daring platform that Vice President Biden could implement if and when he becomes president.
That's exciting to know. My daughter is a Bernie fan, and you know, I think to hear that, if the Democrats can get that message out even louder, then they might have a chance. Who knows? Because you know, there are a lot of as you say, progressives who aren't quite sure what to do here as youngsters. I want to ask you, Reverend Walker, the Supreme Court decision yesterday, or the day before, whatever it was, regarding LGBTQ2 rights, really was newsworthy because of the conservative judges who voted in the majority for that protection. And how does that affect, if at all, how young Democrats in Massachusetts are looking at this, or how does that affect civil rights in general?
Well, Well, I think oppression against anyone is wrong, whether it's oppression for their race or whether it's oppressing them because of their race or oppressing them because of their sexual views or sexual orientation or oppressing them for their gender is wrong and should be condemned. I think oppression in any form is not the best that we can be. And I think that people should be protected from oppression if the oppression is based off race, gender, religious identity or lack thereof, sexual orientation, etc. So it sounds like in this decision handed down from the Supreme Court with, you know, several conservative judges, I might add, it is surprising but yet equally affirming to the idea that most people get it, that oppressing people because of their sexual orientation is just downright wrong.
Since we last talked, besides the George Floyd murder, there was another police killing. And Reverend Walker, how are you looking at this? How are the young Dems, or you as a black man, and your fellow Americans that you know and dealing with them, where are we going with this? How is this looking? Is this still, it doesn't seem to be dying down, and it's a worldwide phenomenon, and this is, in terms of history, the opportunity here do some good, I would think.
Yes, this is, unfortunately, George Floyd was killed at the hands of a white police officer. That's racism manifest in police misconduct, but we've seen this movie before. We've seen what happened with Rodney King. We've seen what happened with Michael Brown. We've seen what happened with Tamar Rice. We've seen what happened with Sandra Bland. We've seen this before. But I think it's a critical moment in our history right now where there's an opportunity to channel this collective outrage and transition it from a moment to a movement. And that's the challenge that we find ourselves in because, yes, black lives do matter. And that's not to say when that expression is said that other lives don't matter, but historically black lives have, we have been marginalized, we have been disenfranchised, since the beginning and the inception of this American experiment. We know that, Africans were brought here, purely for the purpose of slavery, chattel slavery, I might add. So we understand that there has been no oppression in this country like the oppression that African Americans have had to endure for hundreds of years. And when we talk about systemic racism, this isn't just some new thing that we talk about when we talk about when people are saying that enough is enough. Because we can go back to Jim and Jane Crow. We can go back again to slavery, where there's a long history of dehumanizing African Americans. And essentially, we need a revolution of values, as Dr. King said. We need a change. And the only way this change is going to come is through several ways. One, I think what cities are starting to do now is a call for defunding the police. Now, just to be clear, folks, that doesn't mean that taking all the financial resources from the police force, because we understand that those who work in law enforcement also have families to feed, but this is taking a certain amount of money. I know here in Boston, the mayor has rightly called to take away $12 million, I believe, from police overtime and invest it into other community services. We see this widespread movement happening across the country. We also need to end immunity for protection for the police, that police should be held accountable if they use excessive force, and they should not be entitled to immunity. We also should have the ending nationally and in every city and every town, the ending of legal use of excessive force by the police, such as chokeholds. That's atrocious. It's degrading, and it's not called for. So And we also need to understand, how do we think about restorative justice instead of criminal justice? How do we think about restoring people who have committed crimes and restoring broken relationships that have happened because of crimes and restoring individuals who are who have committed the crimes and the victim so folks can be made whole? Because we understand that there is a prison industrial complex and people are profiting off private prisons being built. So we also talk about criminal justice reform. We ought to talk about police reform. And I think what this particular situations that have happened recently, where a young man of color was killed last week in Atlanta, and obviously George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, these are situations, and we can say, and the list goes on and on, of people of color who have died at the hands of police misconduct and police brutality. And I think what the nation is calling for, that's why we see these protests across the country, what the nation and what the citizens are calling for is an end to police brutality, because it's unjust and it's not right.
Well, you know, I don't think anybody could disagree with any of that, especially in light of what we've seen and what's going on. Do you get a sense, you mentioned the word marginalized, Reverend Walker, and I watched Pierre Thomas, an ABC reporter. He's a black reporter on ABC, a very distinguished gentleman, has been on for a long time, and he said something a few weeks ago that I don't think most of us white people really understand in terms of the word marginalization and actually humiliation. And all he said was, he was at a grocery store and he had a tie on, and he was cleaning off his carriage, you know, with the COVID thing, and he was spraying it and cleaning it up. And a woman was standing right beside him, hovering on him, just kind of invading his space. And he looked up at her and said, like, you know, what are you doing? And she sort of intimated, well, you're cleaning that cart for me, aren't you? And it was a very telling moment to me, because he said, it's like, that's so humiliating. You're doing your own thing, going to get your own groceries, but because of the color of your skin, someone's expecting you to wait on her. And that's a minor thing that wasn't violent or anything, but it just pointed out to me what people have to go through sometimes that others aren't aware of. And having said that, in Boston, with the people you're associating with, do you get a feeling that this time there are a lot more other people involved, meaning white people, meaning you know, people across the spectrum in terms of religion and so on? Because watching television, it looks to me like there is definitely a movement going on here.
Yes, and what you refer to, we call that microaggression, when you talk about the story with the black gentleman and they're cleaning his shopping cart, mm-hmm. and the white woman assuming that the black gentleman works there and cleaning it for her, we call that microaggression. And we must be clear that Boston is not free of racism. I mean, we look at, in 2008, the $664 million worth of construction and service contracts, less than 1% went to minority-owned business and businesses owned by women. When we look at the net worth of a black person, we understand, according to the Federal Reserve study a couple years ago here in Boston, that they released their results. They said that the average net worth of a black person is $8, and the average net worth of a white person is $247,000.
Good heavens.
Economic disparity between black and white. And perhaps it is that we're dealing with in this particular city, and you know, albeit the mayor has mentioned that he is that he wants Boston to be a national leader in the fight against racism. Well, let's see what happens. Let's see some action. And what does that mean? What does that mean in terms of where will the money go to funding community programs and communities of color and the budget for next year? So. Yes, to answer your question, I think, or not even your question, your thought, people, the collective consciousness of people are being awakened to the awful realities that people of color face. Again, the challenge is to transition this moment of anger, of righteous indignation, of collective protest into a movement, a peaceful movement, a movement that challenges social injustices in our society, namely put racism. So we, you know, it is a challenge of the hour, but I think people are rising and understanding the urgency of the moment. And I would say to white people, you know, go ahead, you know, read White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. So there's a book there that has a conversation, or that's white people having a conversation with other white people about racism, you know, and white and how damaging it is for white persons who have white privilege, but how damaging it is to other folks of ethnic groups who belong to other ethnic groups who don't have white privilege. So really unpacking privilege and really what that means, and how to be conscious, you know, of the privilege, and how, and the damaging ways that the privilege has, the damaging effects that the privilege has, the white privilege has for white people, for people who aren't white.
Well, now I'm going to have to get that and read it, because you've challenged me, and I want to know more about that. Of course, sometimes one's ignorance comes to the surface, and he doesn't even know about it. So you know, you got to learn about it. I emailed you one time about that, but you know, my final thoughts are, and Reverend Walker, I hope we can do this again, get together soon, and continue the conversation.
Sure.
Excellent. But my final thoughts are. Two hopeful things for me. As an Army brat growing up, you know, I grew up in a multicolored world, and I wasn't aware of all the biases until later on. Number one, the very fact that NASCAR has banned the Confederate flag, to me, is, I don't want to say it's akin to the Berlin Wall coming down, but it's pretty damn close. And then the second thing was when the National Football League and a friend of mine said, no, it's against Colin Kaepernick taking a knee. I think there's an awareness here, finally, that is beginning to take hold.
And this move, and this beginning and this movement is to challenge white supremacy and racial injustice. You know, Colin Kaepernick was taking a knee a long time ago. It wasn't necessarily about him, but he was taking a knee to show that this American experiment has disregarded, historically and currently, has disregarded black lives, disregarded people of color, disregarded sisters and brothers of color because of the color of our skin. And it was Dr. King who talked about that wonderful dream that he had, that he wants to help create a nation that judges people on the content of their character and not the color of their skin. And I believe in order for us to create a more just and equitable world, it's going to take black folks working with white folks, working with brown folks, working with people of faith and people of no faith and people of goodwill and moral conscience, and these folks working together, all of us working together, to say that we are better than the evil that exists in our world, in our society, and we need to rise above it. And the way that we rise above it is collective solidarity and collective unity. And not only that, but this collective solidarity and this collective unity advocating for policies that uplift the marginalized, the disenfranchised, the least of these, the disempowered. You know, and Jesus said something very powerful. He said, "Love." He said, "The second greatest commandment is to love thy neighbor as yourself." You can't love yourself. You can't love your neighbor if you're oppressing your neighbor. You can't love your neighbor if you're contributing. If you're contributing to your neighbor being depressed, you can't love your neighbor if you're not standing in solidarity with your neighbor who is being oppressed against the systemic evils that oppress your neighbor. So essentially, I think a form of loving your neighbor is sitting down, talking with your neighbor, and understanding how we can build collective solidarity and collective unity that we may accomplish the greater good.
Amen to all of that. And evoking Dr. King at this point is so relevant. and that he in that aspect he lives on. I couldn't be in more agreement, and thank you for all of those words. That is the Reverend Vernon Walker, who is the policy director of the Young Democrats of Massachusetts.